Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 5th of August, back after a two-week vacation, northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota. Don't know much about anything except wolves. I saw a wolf, blue herons, and deer, and the water and the sun. And today, I have to put on my thinking cap. Does your mom ever use that phrase with you? Put on your thinking cap. Because it has been absent, just in another vein, natural world, for a couple weeks. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and John Munson for holding down these hours while I was gone. All Things Political is what's happening the first hour of our program today, which you now always hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Ken Rudin is our guest this hour. We're delighted to have NPR's political junkie with us to talk about a number of issues, the chatter on the internet that has closed so many embassies and consulates in the world. We'll be looking at Congress being on a five-week vacation. What do all those people do when they're on vacation? And what will they do, if anything, when they return? You know, we must say this about him. Ken happens to be a big-time Yankees fan, so we'll ask him about these suspensions, which have just come down, and A-Rod appears to be the only baseball player who's going to appeal that decision and can play in the meantime. We will talk about that. Ken will pay tribute to Herb Kaplow, who sounds, I didn't know him, like an absolutely wonderful journalist and human being. The fight for Senator Mitch McConnell's seat, we'll talk about that. The governors of all of the states met in Milwaukee over the last 3 days, and they had some interesting things to talk about. They're concerned about the infrastructure in various states and who's going to pay for improving infrastructure. So all of those are on our agenda for this hour. And here's how you reach our conversation with Ken Rudin, 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, feel free to leave messages there. As you know, Ken is leaving NPR at the end of September. We could spend a whole hour on that. But if you'd like to leave messages about that on our Facebook page, we welcome you to do so. That is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Ken Rudin, hello.
Kathleen, how are you? It's leaving not because of steroids, but too many campaign buttons.
Oh.
I know that they've drawn the line.
Well, I must tell you, and I don't want to spend the hour on this. Maybe we can once you're gone, but I really, really miss Talk of the Nation. It's one of the reasons that I asked to switch our show, because I thought it was a huge void, and I've listened to it for years, and I am just heartbroken that show is no longer on the air. I'm very sorry.
There are a lot of us, a lot of people at NPR who agree with you completely, and so it's regrettable, but I guess we move on, I think.
I guess we have no choice, so we just need to find you a new home.
That's right. I'm thinking of moving to Wisconsin. Well, no, I'm kidding.
You're a Yankees fan. You wouldn't come here.
I know, I'm just going to say that. What A-Rod does is okay, but what Ryan Braun does is not okay.
Exactly. No, you're going to have to take on A-Rod as well as Ryan Braun. But you're right. Wait, I read your piece about Ryan Braun. It was a flat-out lie. He really fooled a lot of people who believed him, myself included. You feel like an idiot.
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, we keep going, just like politics, it's not so much the crime, it's the cover-up. And it's not so much the taking of it. Look, one of the most beloved Yankees is pitcher Andy Pettit, who said, look, I did it. I was wrong,
right.
And I did it. And I think that's the thing. When you have people like Ryan Braun and Alex Rodriguez and others who just blame, first of all, deny it completely, and then blame others for foistering this lie, well, then when it turns out that they've been lying all along, it's hard to have any sympathy for them.
Right. Can you make any comparisons between that world and the political world? You know, every time this happens, I think, how in the world do people think they can get away with this? And you must have seen a lot of this politically, too. How do you think, in your heart of hearts, you can possibly lie and get away with it? Why would you do that?
Well, sometimes they think they're in their politicians. Look, we always talk about egos, and when you have egos, you think you're indestructible.
Right.
And I know while you were on vacation, one of the last things hopefully you were thinking of was Anthony Weiner. But even when Anthony Weiner was caught, then said he was lying, then he lied, then he said, well, you know, they hacked into my Twitter account, and then finally he resigned from Congress. He said, okay, I did it. I'm wrong. I'm sorry. I'm going to be a good family man. I'll never do it again. And then he's running for mayor. Then apparently he has done it again. He has sent out these these ugly tweets to women he didn't know. So, you know, somehow they think they're indestructible, but and especially when you have to appeal to a voting public. It's the one thing to lie to your wife, but when you're lying to 8 million people in New York City and hope to be their next mayor, I don't know how you get away with that. I don't think you do.
Yeah. Where is he now? Is he out of the running?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, the last poll, until recently, until the second lie, until or the third lie, whatever it is, he was up there in the polls and leading. Of course, you know, notoriety will get you up in the polls no matter what. But now the last poll, I saw he's slipping to fourth place. And, of course, he's blaming others. He says, I don't care what people outside, I don't care what people in Westchester County think. And that's a slight at the Clintons who live in Chappaqua, New York. So there are so many things that he's doing wrong, and he's just, I guess he just doesn't see it because he's staying in the race, or at least he insists he'll stay in the race. Whether he does or not will remains to be seen. The primary is September 10th.
Yeah. All of those stories just do something to your spirit, don't they? Particularly this baseball story, because you people do look up to these, and young kids look up to these. Players put their names on their backs when they go to games, and for that reason alone, it just sickens me. It's the national pastime.
Well, you know something, first of all, I think it's past time that they were gone, but I think I agree with you about
right.
that. I think that, you know, nobody, once upon a time, we held Congress in higher esteem than we do now. I think somebody said that colonoscopies are more popular than Congress, but we still love our baseball players. As kids, we remember the Willie Mays and the Mickey Mantles
sure.
and the Hank Aarons mm-hmm. and all those great, Stan Musial, the great players of the past. And then when, look, Alex Rodriguez was never beloved in New York, but Ryan Braun was beloved in Milwaukee.
Yes, he was.
And when he said, no, it's not true, there were so many people who just cared so much about him. They said, he must be telling the truth. And when that falls apart, then you know, what's sacred? Next thing you'll know that Ken Rudin is not telling the truth.
You're always telling the truth.
Well,
right.
No,
we believe in you, Ken.
That's your thing.
And we believe you. All right, let's talk about this chatter. I have yet to understand where this chatter comes from. What chatter are people listening to that caused so many embassies and consulates to close for, I guess, at least the next week?
Well, that's what it looks like. And, you know, there's no information except for the fact that other than the big embassies of Baghdad and Kabul, everything is closing, and there's conversations, there's discussions out there, and they're picking up something. And I don't know what to make of it, except everybody thinks it's serious enough to close the embassies. And working in Washington and working in New York and in the big cities, you know, you still, a lot of people have not, of course, recovered or probably never recover from 9/11. You're always on alert, but around the world, I guess you can never not be on alert, given, you know, the precarious state of world affairs.
And would some of that heightened listening be because of Benghazi, Ken?
Well, Benghazi, I mean, of course, you know, Benghazi, of course, happened on the anniversary of 9/11, and we wonder about that. But you don't know, you know, the chatter out there is just this. Later, you could say, well, it was probably because of that, and nobody seems to know except for the fact that they take it seriously enough to take action.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the National Governors Conference. Took place in Milwaukee over the weekend. I'm sure you paid some attention to that. Some of the governors were complaining, a lot of them actually, about not having enough money for infrastructure. And I thought, whoa, infrastructure, there's something we were talking about a couple years ago, and we're not talking about it much now.
Well, we're certainly not talking about it in Congress. I mean, you know, whenever you think of the governors who were elected in 2010, the Republican governors led by Scott Walker of your state, I mean, Scott Walker at least knows that the national economy is crucial for the state economy. And if the national economy defaults, if the national government, federal government defaults on its debts and its IOUs, then the states will pay the price. So there is a big feud going on between the governors and the Republican members of Congress who are very willing to, some of whom are very willing to shut down the government if they don't get their way. In other words, if there's money for the funding, for the continuing funding of the Affordable Care Act, you know, Obamacare, then they say, okay, if you're going to keep that money in, we'll vote to shut down the government. If you're going to, we're not going to vote to raise the debt ceiling as long as there's money for Obamacare. So in the past, we've seen Republicans take that position. We saw them do that in 1995, 1996. They shut down the government, and they paid the price. Bill Clinton, who was certainly going to be a one-term president, easily won re-election because he ran against Newt Gingrich and the Republican Congress and the closing of government. And while Obama can't run for a third term, of course, it still could certainly hurt the Republicans in 2014 and beyond.
So the next 5 weeks when they're on vacation, will they be hearing things they normally won't hear because they're in Congress or they're in Washington and now they're among their constituents and people are saying, hey, we have these concerns, you better listen to us. Will they be hearing different voices the next 5 weeks?
Well, they will, and that's what's interesting. You know, in 2009, the first summer, I guess the midterm, the summer recess, August recess, after Obama was sworn in, Republicans came home, or members of Congress came home, and they heard of this new group called the Tea Party that was just angry about the spending and the debt and the government-run amok. And the Tea Party made a big deal. Now, a lot of these Republicans will go back to their districts, and more likely than not, they're not going to hear for a great outpouring of gun control or immigration overhaul, because those districts, they come from districts that usually don't support that. But the difference is there are many progressive and liberal groups that are also working this August recess to send their troops out and about and said, look, what about the farm bill? Where is the jobs bill? What about gun control in the wake of what happened in Newtown? What about what's going on with immigration? The Senate passed it overwhelmingly, and the House is doing nothing. So the Republicans may come home to their districts and hear voices that they haven't heard in their districts in a long time because the changing voices that are coming out.
It's amazing when you think about what they're going to face when they get back to work in 5 weeks. It's just what they haven't been able to work on before they left, right? It's all the same issues.
And not only that, they, according to the calendar, they come back the second week of September. The government funding ends September 30th. They've only scheduled 9 working days of the month of September. So they have to pass the continuing revolution to keep the government funded. And if they don't, I mean, they only have 9 days to do that. They can't agree on the time of day, let alone funding the government. So there are some Republicans who say, look, this is insane. We've got to, you know, we may not get our way, but look, we have a Democratic president, and there's a Democratic Senate, and we just have to negotiate. And there are other Republicans who say, look, we were elected, we promised our constituents that we would fight Obamacare, we would fight the big government, and we're going to stick to our guns. So before the Democrats and Republicans can get their act together, a lot of people saying that the Republicans within their own party need to get their act together.
I want to ask your thoughts about whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing. Craig Gilbert, who's going to be with us, I think, on Thursday of this week, had an interesting piece, Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, saying that there are now, and I didn't realize the number was this high, Ken, 37 states in America that now have one-party rule. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it makes sense. I mean, because we have elections that some seats switch one way, some switch the other. But we've had a bunch of elections in recent years that went overwhelmingly one way or the other. In 2006, after 6 years of George W. Bush and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the rising food prices and Katrina and the disgust with the Republicans, the Democrats got the majority of the House and Senate. Nancy Pelosi became the first female speaker. And then in 2008, that anti-Republican tide continued with Barack Obama's election. Then when things didn't go the way a lot of people went, the voters went the complete opposite way in 2010, voting out Democrats who've been there for decades and elected the largest Republican class since the 1920s, actually. They picked up a net gain of 63 House seats. So when they have these momentous and monumental switches like this in party control, everything seems to go, like the state legislatures as well. And, of course, as we learned with redistricting and the way members of Congress hold their seats, the state legislatures and the governors, it's a real hidden secret in politics. They control. They wield tremendous power, especially when it comes to redistricting.
Yeah. Ken Rudin is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, the 5th of August, and we welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We've touched on a few issues already, the continuing chatter that has resulted in U.S. embassies being closed. We can talk a little baseball if you want. What is it with people who lie? It's not just baseball players. It's politicians as well. I don't quite understand that. Perhaps you can shed light. And as a society, what is it we're supposed to do about those people we hold in esteem for their athletic abilities or their political abilities? What happens when they really let you down? Ken has written about the fight for Senator Mitch McConnell's seat, which is an interesting one, and we'll talk a little bit about that. He has a tribute to someone that he worked with and has enormous respect for, Herb Kaplow, who died recently. We will talk about that. What about infrastructure? People at the National Governors Conference, governors expressing concern that they weren't getting enough federal money for infrastructure projects that are needed. I wanted to ask Ken about the fast food strikes. We've seen a wave of those now. Will we see more of those? Will it result in an increase in the minimum wage or not? What do you think? Phone lines are open for you right now. Ken Rudin is, for a little while longer at least, NPR's political junkie. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I am Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ken Rudin is with us now. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's start our calls with John in Janesville. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
All right, John, how are you?
Real good.
Good.
I was just wondering if the minimum wage, they said that it's going to go up to maybe 9 or something, would the other wages then go up that high or go up more too? Because I know people that have been at places in Janesville for, you know, 8, 9 years, and they're finally up to $10 an hour because they don't pay very well at most of the factories and stuff anymore. So they're up to $10 an hour. Well, if minimum wage goes up $8 or $9, that means prices will go up. So that means people that have worked for, you know, 8, 9, 10 years to get up to $10 an hour, actually their buying power would go down to nothing. They'd be broke almost.
Ken?
Yeah, well, that's what a lot of small businessmen, and I mean short people, I mean small businessmen who own these small businesses, I mean, that's what they've been talking about for the longest time. Every time you raise the minimum wage, you make it more expensive for these businessmen to keep people employed, and especially for, you know, those who have like 50 employees or fewer. But at the same time, there are so many people who just cannot survive on $7, $8, and on $9. I mean, I assume if prices go up, then wages go up, and then
Sure. Start
talking about inflation. But, you know, as Kathleen, as you talked about earlier in the show about these food strikes that are going around, that's saying, you know, that we're going to picket until you start paying us $15 an hour or even more. I mean, there's some mega firms that can afford that, but so many can't. And that's, you know, that's a slippery spiral that you do, that once you start raising it a little bit, then you start raising prices, and it just keeps going up and up, and that explains much of the inflation, like the 70s and early 1980s.
Yeah. What did the president, I seem to have missed this address, I was probably listening to the loons, but what did the president...
Wait, are you talking about politics or
no,
the real birds.
But I could have been thinking about politics as well. What did the president say in his address about inequality, wage inequality, Ken?
Well, you know, you caught me on this one. I mean, I can't recall specifically what he talked about, except for the fact that the Republicans, I mean, if we're talking the political angle of it, that he has been proposing jobs creation and jobs programs, and the Democrats in Congress have been doing it, and the Republicans have been stopping it, you know, fighting him tooth and nail on every step of the way. I mean, he did talk about increasing the minimum wage, but he never talked about the $15 that so many of the protesters are talking about.
Yeah. Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. Welcome back.
Thanks, Scott.
And Mr. Junkie, I miss you guys, too.
No.
I just so hated when your show went off. But I'm glad to be able to talk to Kathleen in the afternoons, too. And since you're both, I know, baseball fans, obviously, I got a book recommendation for you, Kathleen.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of who? It's a new book by a guy named Philip Bondi, and it's called Who's on Worst? W-O-R-S-T. The lousiest players, biggest cheaters, saddest goats, other anti-heroes in baseball history. So anyhow, I got out of the library, and I'm enjoying the heck out of it.
All right.
So,
both all right, we're on it. We'll book it.
Great. My question for you, Mr. Rudin, is we've heard so much about the gerrymandering of all these districts, and so many of the members of the House of Representatives have safe seats. And so if that's so locked in for them, how does this body ever actually change hands? What dynamic allows enough of a very minority party to win enough districts to take control of that house?
Well, it's not only, I mean, look, everybody's talking about the reason that the Republicans are doing so well in the House is because of redistricting. And there's some truth to that, although, you know, for years when the Democrats ran the thing, the show, the Democrats had the majority in the state legislatures, and they drew the districts their way. You know, whoever has the power will draw the districts. But there's also part of the problem for the Democrats is that, like, for example, in many minority districts, the black, Latino, the poor, they all seem to be in this very concentrated area in the states. So basically, unlike, you know, the white, the rural, the Republicans, they're all spread out. When you have something so concentrated in one district or two, you just basically limit your potential for winning seats. Now, of course, demographics are changing. We keep talking about how, you know, we're looking at Texas and all the seats the Republicans have. If the demographics do change, and the demographics seem to be changing in states like Texas, there will be a change in political control. However, as you know, with redistricting, it's once every 10 years. So many people feel that the Republicans are assured, all but assured, of controlling the House, at least in 2020. And the question is, with increased Latino strength, do the Republicans acknowledge it now and work to get some kind of immigration overhaul to get some political gaining out of it, let alone the fact that it may be the right thing to do? Or do they fight them tooth and nail and then suffer the consequences when the demographics change? And that's what the Republicans have to be thinking about.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate all your information, and good luck to you in the future.
Scott, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the call. And when you look at going back to those 37 states in one party, it's my understanding, Ken, that redistricting has allowed those states to remain pretty safe. Are we looking at states that are going to be blue or red, and it's been etched in the redistricting, so it'll be forevermore?
Well, you know, I mean, that's not, I mean, of course, as I said, as demographics change, things will change. And yes, there are, but if you look at the states in the presidential election, states like Ohio and Florida and Virginia, these were ones, and even Colorado, these were states that would always vote Republican, and now that's changing. So you could say, well, maybe the House is not changing that much, but certainly in the presidential election, states are changing. And if you look at the governors, I mean, there are governors, you know, Republican governors in Pennsylvania and Maine, and Florida, they could be in big, these governors probably are running really, really scared in 2014. So the House may not change that much, and the Republicans may control that part of the government. But if you look at the presidential election, the gubernatorial election, things like that, there's a lot of change happening. And you know, it's not going to be a status quo election, except for maybe perhaps the House.
So the fight for Senator Mitch McConnell's seat, is it going to be an extremely interesting race?
Oh, it's an amazingly interesting race because, one, you know, just like the Republicans were dying to beat Harry Reid in 2010, and they probably, or 2010, yeah, and they probably would have beaten them had the Republicans not put up such a right-wing candidate, Tea Party candidate, I mean, very, very conservative candidate who said a lot of controversial things, and they would have loved to have taken down, you know, their Democratic leader. Well, for the same token, the Democrats would love to take down Mitch McConnell. He, you know, of course, he of the famous quote, that his goal is really to make Obama a one-term president.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Democrats have always been out to get him. Sometimes they run very, very close. Sometimes Mitch McConnell had very, very close elections, and he did in 2008, which was a very anti-Republican year. He had a fight for that fifth term. But what's complicating McConnell's fortunes in 2014 is that now everything he's done is really to anger the Democrats, but to keep his right-wing base solid.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have a Tea Party challenger by the name of Matt Bevin, who says that McConnell is too liberal, he's too much of the establishment, he's been there too long, he helped the immigration bill get to the Senate floor, even though he voted against it. He voted to stop the filibuster. So McConnell is not only being challenged by the Democrats, he's also being challenged by the right wing of his own party. And if that's if a right wing challenger makes him move more to the right to win the primary, then that, of course, puts up the risk of him turning off moderate and centrist voters in November against the Democrats. So Mitch McConnell is in a bind there.
It's hard to believe you can make a campaign over the fact that Mitch McConnell is too liberal, right?
Well, you know something, but that's a very good point. Liz Cheney, for example, is running for the Senate in Wyoming, and she said that Mike Enzi, who has a lifetime American Conservative Union voting record of 93%, she says he's too liberal. When Mike Lee defeated Senator Bob Bennett in Utah, he was one of the most conservative in 2010. Bennett was one of the most conservative senators anywhere, but not conservative enough. So, you know, you talk about the old days of baseball. Well, the old days of politics, Bob Dole and Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon were nominal conservatives. Now, you know, you wonder if even Reagan would win a primary today, given the fact that he has been kind of moderate in so many social issues.
Right.
The party keeps moving more and more to the right, and that satisfies their base, but how do they recapture the White House? And that's the question they have to be asking them.
Yeah. And what about that baseball book? Have you heard about it? Who's unworst?
No, but I think, Philip Bondi, I know him. And, you know, what I love about books like that, we love lists. You know, America's favorite Nazi war criminals. You know, we love lists. So that's the kind of book I would love to see. You know, favorite Yankees, worst trades in history. because they have books like that, too. I love those.
Okay.
And you know something?
That's
one thing about baseball, too. In the old days, you know, Mickey Mantle, at his peak, made $100,000. Most of the players got $40,000, $50,000. Now that they're making multi-million dollar contracts, they have this unbelievable pressure to excel and, in some ways, in some instances, cheat. And, of course, you know, because there's so much money at stake, it's no longer just playing for the joy of the game, as we like to think of the 50s and 60s. But now with multi-million dollar contracts, I think the New York Yankees owe A-Rod, $125 million?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I don't make that in 5 years.
Sure you don't. Wouldn't you feel guilty making that much money? I would.
Let me think for a second. No.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Our number, by the way, lines have been busy. Ken Rudin is our guest, NPR's political junkie. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we have a Facebook message from Ryder. As most of us know, people are speculating about Scott Walker running for president. When was the last time the U.S. had a president who was not a college graduate?
Wow, that's a great question. boy, I think that whoever asked that question deserves that political junkie T-shirt we used to give away for those trivia questions.
But the T-shirts are all gone?
No, there will be a new political junkie segment program that I'm going to distribute, and there will be new T-shirts and buttons.
Oh, good.
I know. America needs.
Okay.
It. But that's a great question. I can't think of.
Was it Harry Truman? Was he?
Well, it could be Harry Truman. It could be Harry Truman. Certainly, everybody since him has. I mean, Eisenhower. Yeah, I think everybody has.
Right.
Well, maybe Truman. Wow.
Huh.
And then, of course, Scott Walker, if he's running for president, he may have to fight out Mr. Ryan as well to see, you know, so you may have two presidential Republican candidates coming out of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Randy in Sauk County, hi.
Yeah, I just can't imagine NPR without you, Ken, like Hepburn and Tracy, maybe, you know.
Which one am I, Hepburn or Tracy?
But my question is this, you know, there's a little more depth to analysis now. I think that everything is the Republicans are going to have to come up with a slate, and the Democrats, the field is wide open, and so on. So everybody's really looking maybe a little deeper. They could have just been listening to you, by the way, over the years, but instead they're analyzing it themselves. But I wonder what your question is, or your answer to this question. Here in Wisconsin, when the governor was elected, defeated, booted out in his recall. And then the presidential election, it was a great, to me, a great example. The same voters voted almost in the same proportion for what the politicians say was exactly opposite, but somehow they see these two forces the same. And I am fascinated by that, and I wonder what your analysis of that is.
Well, that's a good question. And I remember when during the successful recall, the beat back of the recall election by Walker, the polls still showed that President Obama would take Wisconsin. And what I got out of it is maybe, I mean, this is my personal feeling, and I don't know if this is what it was, but there's something unfair about a recall election. And I understand that you could have a strong feeling, look, maybe Scott Walker said he would do something when he was running for governor in 2010, and maybe he went back on his word, and there comes a recall, and I understand that. Same with Gray Davis in California. He may have disappointed people, but I think, you know, not that you're stuck with him, but, you know, you run for office, you're elected, and you defeat him the next time around. So I kind of think that all the millions of dollars that went in for and against Walker, it just seemed like, I know I'm disappointing a lot of people by saying for a lot of people who really wanted Walker gone, but the argument I say is defeat him in 2014. Don't have elections every you know, 6 minutes, like when Tom DeLay tried to have new redistricting in Texas to help the Republicans. You do it once every 10 years. You just follow that tradition. I think it just backfires on people. So I don't know if I mean, it is interesting that a lot of people who voted against the recall did vote for Obama, but I think it doesn't seem as far-fetched as it would be on paper. I don't think it's about ideology. I think it's just more about process, at least with Walker.
And what's interesting to me, Ken, is that nobody seemed to catch on to that before the recall. Nobody even brought that up until after it was over.
Well, there were some Democrats who said, whoa, don't do this. You know, don't
worry. Were there?
This may not be the smart thing, but there were so many, the unions in Wisconsin were so angry. We saw what Republican governors were doing, you know, also with Kasich in Ohio.
Yeah.
So you did see a lot of anger among the unions, and it just seemed like they got ahead of themselves, and they just pushed forward, and ultimately, obviously, it made Scott Walker a much stronger candidate, a much stronger governor.
And Rhonda has done the research, and KP, Truman was the last president without a college degree.
Wow, Rhonda doesn't get a T-shirt, though.
She doesn't?
No, I'm sorry.
Do I get one?
We'll talk later.
Thank you. Thanks, Randy, for the call. Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm one of the other people that looked forward to you when you were on Wednesdays, Ken. I just wanted to point out that there were a number of people trying to make a message with the National Governors Association in town. And one of the groups that I thought was more interesting was one that supports amending the U.S. Constitution to say that money is not considered speech. And I wanted to point out that not only do I think there's a possibility that nationwide referendum like that would pass, but that here in Wisconsin we actually had a statewide referendum on campaign finance reform in the 90s, and it passed by a landslide, even though it was advisory, so nothing policy-wise was done with it.
Right, nothing binding. Right. Well, look, you know, I mean, we're talking about the Citizens United case, and we're talking about what the Supreme Court has ruled. And I don't see, look, you know, there could be a lot of people who are saying there's too much money in politics, of course. And there is, their argument has been made that there's much too much money in politics. And usually that's people who make that argument on the left side of the aisle. But there's, you know, there are people on the left who say, you know, the George Soros of the world say, well, we're going to pump in money as well. Until you have a new Supreme Court, which is not going to happen anytime soon, that Citizens United campaign is here to stay. And we were talking earlier about Mitch McConnell. I mean, that's money equals free speech. That has been McConnell's argument from the beginning, and it's probably why the reason why he is the Republican leader in the Senate, because that has been his go-to theme, you know, for decades with him, and Republicans really respect that. So I know there are a lot of people who around the country who are trying to pass initiatives to try to, you know, and some states, you know, state policy has changed. There are limits in state government, like Maine has it, other states have it. But as far as federal elections, presidential elections, that's not going to change unless you have another a new Supreme Court.
Ken Rudin is our guest. All Things Political is what you're listening to here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One line is open for Ken, 800-486-8655 is the number. You can send an email at talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today. It was 1 year ago today that a white supremacist walked into the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, opened fire. Six people were killed. Three people were injured. The temple has been holding a memorial commemoration since last Friday. Tonight there will be a candlelight vigil at the temple. And we have extraordinary guests with us. Their story, I know these people and I've seen their work, and they just... you just can't ignore what they're doing. The sons of the temple president, Satwant Singh Kalika, who was one of those killed last year, will be with us, Amardeep and Pardeep, and also a former white supremacist who contributed so much to the white power movement that he believed that he may have helped influence the shooter to commit this act of terror. So he, Arno Michaelis, reached out to Pardeep, and they formed an organization, Serve to Unite. They have met with families from other tragedies like Newtown, the Boston Massacre. There was a Newtown family survivor, mother, father, and sister at one of the memorials over the weekend. Plus, they've reached out to tough Central City neighborhoods and to people around the world who are in communities that don't get along with each other and maybe have been violent at one point toward the other. So all those people will be with us, Pardeep and Amardeep and Arno, to talk about what happened a year ago and what they have done since. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Let's go to John in Elkhorn. Ken Rudin is our guest on All Things Political. Hello, John.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hello, Ken. We miss you. The reason I'm calling is that about a couple months ago, Kathleen had on her as a guest Olympia Snow. And Olympia Snow is out there right now promoting a book that basically stresses bipartisanship in a way to solve some of the problems in Congress. At the same time, as it's been pointed out, Olympia attended a meeting where Mitch McConnell made that comment, let's make Obama a one-term president. And I just find it very disingenuous that people in Congress, you know, who seem to know how bad things are, don't really do anything while they're there. But once they get out of office, I mean, it's easy for them to come out and, you know, start telling us what's wrong with it. And a lot of times it comes down to the inaction on their own part, you know, while they were there. What say you?
Well, you know, that's interesting. There's no question that people like Olympia Snow and her, the other senator from Maine who's still there, Susan Collins, they do reach across the aisle more so than most Republicans. But we've seen also for the last couple of cycles that anybody, Democrat or Republican, once they start talking to the other side, they're collaborating with the enemy, and they're immediately threatened with a primary challenge. I got to understand, look, Joe Lieberman, the Democrat turned independent in Connecticut, of course, he was supporting the war for a long time, and there was a big opposition to that. But other senators like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, both Lindsey Graham and John McCain are very conservative, but they've been challenged with primary. I mean, McCain survived the 2010 primary, Lindsey Graham has an opponent in 2014 because they have the temerity to go across the aisle to talk to them. So, I mean, you know, there are some people out there, you know, Rob Portman of Ohio, Bob Corker of Tennessee, Republicans.
Yeah.
Look, being right-wing for the purpose of being right-wing, just to prove a point, is lunacy, especially if we're never going to get the White House again, if you're not going to, you know, cooperate. But there are other Republicans who just, you know, keep quiet. They say, look, every time I think about coming up, I get a phone call from somebody on my right wing who says, you know, you say something and you'll pay for it in the primary. NRA is known for that. NRA says, if, you know, there are some... Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania are hardly liberals, and certainly not liberals on guns. And yet, when they tried to do that compromise on guns, the NRA said, not with our approval.
Yeah.
Then I guess my main one comment would be is, it's not the lack of bipartisanship; it's the lack of integrity and cojones just to say, you know what, I don't care about being reelected or who's gonna they're gonna put up against me. At some point, I just have to do what's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're absolutely. We're talking about profiles and courage. You're absolutely right. There are too few of those kind of members on both sides of the aisle.
Well, shame on them, because that certainly is the way to live, isn't it, Ken? You want to do what's right.
Well, yes, you do, and then unless you think the most important thing is getting reelected,
right.
You know, as John says, you know, if that's the most important thing, then you'll just never stand up, and on your tombstone, it'll just say he got reelected, and that's hardly what I want to see on my tombstone.
Yeah. Well, speaking of dying, we do want to elevate the good too, and you wrote some beautiful things about a man who you had a great respect for and worked with, and I've read, because of your comments about him, others who have been paying tribute to Herb Kaplow, who sounded like he was just the best in the business, huh?
He absolutely was. Let me just say a little bit quickly about him. You know, he spent 21 years at NBC News and 22 years at ABC News. He covered the Nuremberg trials. He covered the civil rights movement. He covered, when he was in the South, in Selma and Mississippi, the Klan cross burnings and the police dogs and the fire hoses. He was at like 9 or 10 political conventions. He covered Richard Nixon from the time he was vice president to his resignation. But more importantly, he was a decent, good guy. If he gave his word, you knew he would keep it. It was unlike the most of the journalists you see, especially on TV lately. This was never about Herb Kaplow. It was always about getting the truth out, getting the story out. And he, like, when, just a personal thing. When I first came to ABC in Washington in 1986, Herb and all these senior correspondents would say, "You know, we're going out to lunch. Let's bring the kid." He was always good to, you know, the once upon a time I was young, and once upon a time I had lunch. But he was always so good to people who were coming up, we were all teary-eyed at his funeral, and yet it was not about the stuff he covered. It was just about what a decent and honest and good-natured person he was. And there are so few of those. When you think of journalists today, you don't think of how great some of them were. And this guy, you know, loved his family. He was just like the best of the best, and I miss him tremendously.
Mm. I'm glad you pay tribute like that. It's good for us to remember the best of the best.
There are some of them. There absolutely are.
Bill in DeForest. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good afternoon. I would sure love to see the Ken and Kathleen show be a regular feature every week.
I would too, anyway. But I don't know what he's going to be doing, but we got to help him find a permanent place, right?
But would it be the Kathleen and Ken show or the Ken and Kathleen show?
You could have first billing, okay, Ken and Kathleen, for the first week, and then the next week it would be the Kathleen and Ken show.
Sounds like a John Kerry every week.
Could be the K and K show.
There you go.
Anyway, I've got a couple issues, but one of them is politicians that are signing pledges, you know, with the Grover Norquist pledges, and then there's another one that the Milwaukee Journal did a story on a couple weeks ago about Walker and Ron Johnson and most of the state Republican senators signing pledges for, I believe it was Americans for Prosperity, on the energy tax credits. I'm not quite sure. I can't quite remember it exactly. But what is wrong with what is right about signing pledges? To me, it looks like a conflict of interest. And isn't their oath of office the only pledge that really is the binding pledge that a politician should adhere to?
Well, you know, that's important, Bill. I usually don't have that many obvious public feelings feelings about issues that I make public. But I feel exactly the same way you do. Things change. I mean, it's very possible you could make I'm not going to raise taxes. You make it in 1980, and suddenly the economy is falling apart in 2000. You say, wait a second, things have changed. Saxby Chambliss, the Republican senator who's now retiring in Georgia, but a year or so ago, he said, look, my oath is to the Constitution. My oath is to the people of Georgia. My oath is not to Grover Norquist. So he took his name back from that no tax pledge. And I think that's courageous, but of course the Tea Party went ballistic and Saxby Chambliss decided to retire. But I agree. I mean, you know, you sign what the pledge you're signing is to follow uphold the Constitution. And things do change. Look, sometimes when you're coming into Congress, you're running for something, you sign, you know, the contract with America. But ultimately, if it works, it's fine. If situations change, then you have to move along with it. Otherwise, then you're not really voting your conscience. You're just voting, you know, what other people insist that you do vote on. So it's very disconcerting, many people who just stick to it because they signed it.
Bill, thanks. Kip in Manitoba. Hi, Kip.
Hi. Yes, this is the first time I'm hearing your show, and I'm actually here for part of the summer in Frankfort, Michigan, across the lake.
Oh.
But I had a sort of comment and question. In Manitoba, we currently have a 4.2% unemployment rate. We have a minimum wage of $10.25. And we have a cost of living that's comparable to, I'd say, the middle part of the U.S. And I wonder why it is that Americans are so afraid of raising the minimum wage, and even with your guest speaker today saying that it could increase inflation, it could create problems. We don't have those problems occurring there, and I wonder why the U.S. is so resistant to looking at a place like Canada to see that these things have been solved a long time ago and that it works very well there.
Thanks, Kip, for your call. Ken?
Yeah, I don't really know how to answer that question, although there are some studies that do show that when you do raise the minimum wage, you know, a lot of small businesses do suffer consequences, and then they raise the prices, and so there's a spiral there. But the way you're describing Manitoba, it sounds like ideal and certainly workable. Look, every situation is different. Every region in the country is different. But a lot of it has to do with political philosophy. And for, you know, for Democrats, they feel that raising the minimum wage has always been a winning issue, and Republicans has been a winning issue to oppose it.
Maybe they're looking for a political junkie in Manitoba, and you'd be paid very well.
Yeah, right. Would it be the Ken show or the Ken and Kip show?
It would be the Ken show, the Ken Rudin show.
Right, Kenny.
Just a quick comment about baseball buying the owner of the Red Sox buying the Boston Globe. Is that weird or not?
You know what's so weird about it? Not so much the baseball part, but when the New York Times bought the Boston Globe in, I think, 1993, they paid like $1.3 billion for it, and they sold it for $70
million. Wow.
I mean, it just shows the decline of the value of the newspaper. But, you know, for the longest time, just like we've seen the story about Newsweek, Boston Globe was losing money, hemorrhaging money. And that's true about so many newspapers around the country, and it's heartbreaking.
It is.
I mean, so many cities that used to have at least two competing newspapers now have one. Some of them are even losing one. Just nobody reads the newspapers anymore. It's just, you know, I don't know if they get their news from Jon Stewart and that's sufficient, or they don't get it at all. But I think they just get it on the web, and that's heartbreaking because there is so much on the web that's just so unsubstantiated, so just rumor-ridden. But, you know, it's free, and if it's on the web, it must be true.
I guess. Here, somebody suggested the K2 show. How's that?
K2, yeah.
You like
K2,
that?
K2 Brutus. Just
Oh, I hope you find another spot. Can you give us, we only have about 30 seconds, can you give us any inkling of what you want to do?
What I'm doing is I'm doing regular two ways with member stations around the country. I'm also going to do a standalone political junkie segment that'll be distributed. I think it'll be a podcast as well, once a week that people can download, and the political junkie column and the scuttle button puzzle, that'll all come back as well.
Good. Well, thank you, Ken. You can always be here with us. Always.
I always love coming there. Thank you.
Thank
so
you,
much.
Ken. Ken Rudin, our guest, political junkie. For NPR, and we lament the loss of Talk of the Nation. So thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this interesting hour. Please stay tuned. We should have an important hour coming up. the one-year anniversary of the Oak Creek massacre.